Welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast, the companion podcast to digitallydownloaded.net. I'm Matthew Sainsbury. I'm the editor-in-chief of Digitally Downloaded. And with me this week, we have Matt.
Hello.
James.
Howdy.
Good to have you on the podcast. We're going to do a bit of a themed one this week. We've all been hitting up the Internet Archive to play various classic games, and we're going to be talking about those, the games we played over the next couple of 40 minutes or so. Should be a good conversation, get back to our roots of gaming, and yeah, let's get stuck straight into it. This week, usually we start with a Hatsune Miku track, but this time I felt we could start with something from IA or IA or however you want to pronounce it, a different Vocaloid, a really cool Vocaloid, good song. Have a listen. Okay, so Internet Archive. I don't know if the listeners out there have discovered that as yet, but basically it's a dumping ground for a whole bunch of games that are basically out of license, or copyright has expired on them, or for whatever reason, the developers don't have access to them anymore. So it's kind of like a place where you can go to experience the games of yesteryear, DOS and so on. For this week, we all kind of picked a game or two to play from there to get back to our roots. And Matt, what did you play first?
So I played, on your recommendation, Matt, Wizardry Wizardry Proving Grounds of the Mad Overlord, which is a sort of dungeon crawler that came out in 1981. And I know you swear by it, but I hated every minute of it because it came out about 8 years before I was even born, and it just hasn't aged, and I found it impossible to play. So it's basically, well, it's a dungeon crawler, so it's an RPG. You create your character, you assign their stats, and you go off on fighting through dungeons looking for treasure and fighting monsters. But yeah, again, product of its time. It's very, by today's standards, the interface is very clunky and difficult to kind of wrap your head around. It's very obtuse to the point that I had to use a walkthrough just to like be able to play it at all. And yeah, I can appreciate that for its time, it was very good and quite genre defining even. But to play it now for the first time in 2017, I think requires a lot of commitment to gaming history.
Well, genre defining is probably an understatement. As far as I'm aware, I'm pretty sure, 99% sure, that it was the first dungeon crawler. First dungeon crawler that was ever made. It was certainly the first one that was any kind of, that had any kind of popularity. So the reason I guess I recommended Wizardry to you was because basically every dungeon crawler that has come since kind of owes its existence to what Wizardry did. And yeah, obviously it's side, especially around the interface, as you mentioned. The difficulty is all over the place a lot of the time, and obviously it's not particularly attractive game, although it has that kind of retro vibe for RPGs that some people enjoy. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of it's a game that you kind of it has as much importance to the history of games as stuff like Super Mario Brothers or Conker. You know, it's that kind of game that kind of kick-started everything off. So yeah, it's kind of, it's worth experiencing, is what I'm saying, even if you don't particularly enjoy it, because a lot of games that you do probably enjoy wouldn't be around if it wasn't for that one.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. I think it is, as much as I didn't enjoy playing it, it's quite interesting, I guess, seeing that the origins of those sorts of games. And yeah, it looks, with its sort of retro feel, it doesn't look too bad. I mean, it looks, sounds like I'm taking a crack at it, but no, it looks quite good, and even today it has that sort of artistic style that makes it stand out, I think.
It's the kind of the thing about the like, I suppose, games from that sort of pre console crash that happened in the early 80s is like, it was never really so much about the look as it was about trying to draw players in with like something mirroring depth, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Some kind of gameplay. I think for that reason, going back and looking at something like Wizardry would be completely interesting, just purely to see how they approach the gameplay problems that would come up from having such a small amount of memory to work with on those computers back then, and also seeing if there's any kind of I suppose, like dungeon RPG tropes that they began back then that have been retained throughout, you know, the history of RPGs. I think that something like that would be kind of interesting. But I mean, as far as, I mean, I haven't played it, but like looking at it, it looks like it would be a task.
Yeah. And I guess, yeah, if you're really interested in that history, it's probably a task with doing it. I think it is worth checking out at least to see what it's like. But yeah, it's quite can be quite a chore to play if you are 20, however old I am.
Well, I mean, 27. If you think about it, it's like a
in the game, it's like 30 years old. 30.
It's mostly what, like text based. It looks like
it's mostly text based and with some minimal graphics.
Yeah, which is only like
sort of vector graphics for the
those kind of minimal graphics are actually quite appealing to the kind of the old school dungeon crawler fan. There was a game that was released on the DS, I don't know, a decade ago now or whatever, called The Darkspire. And in The Darkspire, there was actually the option to switch the graphics over to that kind of wireframe dungeon layout that people would have remembered of Wizardry. So that's kind of cool. I mean, it's probably something that people won't get unless they're already into that whole genre, but I think the nostalgia certainly helps people kind of enjoy those games even today. The other thing that kind of Wizardry was well known for was having these kind of dungeon designs that were very difficult to really kind of make your way through without having an actual book of grid paper next to you as you're playing and drawing out the map as you play along. There was no auto mapping in those early games. So lost very quickly and kind of not be able to find your way back out again unless you actually were drawing the map yourself as you're going along. And people like that. I mean, if you look at the Etrian Odyssey series today, which is still going quite strong on the Nintendo handhelds, that mapping side of things is a really kind of compelling gameplay of dungeon crawlers. And I think a lot of kind of modern dungeon crawlers that kind of do the mapping for you is actually, they're kind of actually a little bit disappointing from that point of view. As clunky as it is to actually have the physical book of map of grid paper next to you, that's kind of part of the appeal of the genre. And you've got to go back to the older games to kind of get that. The other thing that's interesting, obviously, about Wizardry, and I'm not sure how far Matt probably doesn't know too much about it, but Wizardry is an interesting series in that it started as a Western developed series, Sirtec, I believe the name of the developer was, until the 8th Wizardry, I believe, and then a Japanese publisher bought the license to it or acquired the license to it when Sirtec went belly up, I think. And then since then, every Wizardry game that has been released since has been Japanese developed. And they don't get released in English much anymore. So the series has quite a strong branding in Japan for whatever reason, but
yeah, it's actually kind of faded out here. It's actually cited in PC Magazine as being, along with Ultima, as being one of the inspirations for JRPGs, like Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest.
Yeah, that's what I was just wanting to say, and I'm glad you bring that up because I'm actually very much playing Dragon Quest VIII at the moment and enjoying that. But yeah, that is quite specifically like the creator of Dragon Quest cites Wizardry and Ultima as the inspiration for that.
Yeah, wow.
And basically he wanted to take those sort of games and somehow make it work on a console with a controller rather than mouse and keyboard. And that was basically how JRPGs were born. So, and it's quite interesting if you've played like the NES Dragon Quest games, to go back then and play Wizardry and see the similarities. Even though they're very different, there are still a lot of those similarities.
The other really interesting thing, just to, I guess, wrap up this little conversation, Cirtec actually produced an awful lot of very highly talented developers. The most obvious one I think everybody would know is Brenda Romero actually got her start working on Wizardry games. So, yeah, that's
cool.
It's kind of one of those, you know, you look at ID Soft and obviously it produced a lot of industry legends. Cirtec did a very similar thing. I say that if you're interested in the history of games, and if you're interested in the development over time of the RPG genre, you kind of do need to go back and play some of these Wizardry games just to kind of feel for where a lot of the ideas that drove them came from.
Or watch someone else play them, so then that way you can get that experience without having to play it yourself.
Of the game that James played, and he's going to talk us through playing that game and whether it holds up today. Take it away, James.
Boy, oh, does it hold up. It's funny because, like, Wiz and Liz is a game from the Sega, Genesis, or Mega Drive, depending on which part of the world you're from. It was developed by a group that I'd never heard of called Raising Hell Software, but it was published by one of my favorite publishers of the time, Psygnosis, who put out a lot of wonderful games back in the 90s. And WizenLiz is a relatively simple, pretty fast side-scroller that harks back to a time where kind of gameplay was king, I suppose. It's, you know, there's a light story that sort of dances around the idea of being on an alien planet. You play one of, like, either two wizards. You can play as either a male wizard or a female wizard, which is kind of ahead of its time for back then. And the way that it works is that you... The levels are quite small, so they loop around on each other really quickly. And because of the speed of the movement, that's kind of where the difficulty in the gameplay comes from. So you have to herd up all of these. They're called wabbits. They're actually rabbits. But they, once you herd them, they release a magical word or a letter for a magic word. And once you collect all of those letters and spell out the magic word, then all of the rest of the rabbits in the level will unleash, or once you hit them, they will let out like a piece of fruit or like a bonus, like a time bonus or something like that, that adds to your score that you that tallies up at the end of the level. You're given a time limit to find all the letters and increase your score as much as possible, but then you also have to take into account that sometimes there are multiple rounds, so and that timer will span both of those rounds, so you have to give yourself enough time to complete the final round without, you know, running out of time and losing a life. But also try to maximize your score. And it, you know, it's one of those things that's like, it's just a super cute looking game. It reminds me of almost, this might sound reductive and it might sound like I'm making fun of it, but it's not, because I'm not such a huge fan of like platforming games so much these days. But this sort of takes me back to a time when I used to love platforming games. The Genesis for me was one of the consoles that had a lot of these kind of great B-tier side scrollers and platformers that weren't, you know, character heavy like the Mario games were, you know, or the Sonic games. They weren't about to set up a franchise or something like that. But they were still just all about the fun of the game. And something got, like, I played WizenLiz for probably about 45 minutes, and I just had a stupid grin on my face the whole time. It still absolutely holds up. It's the kind of thing that I think you could play on a phone these days. It could easily be transported to, like, iOS, and it's the kind of thing that I would play on my phone. I was actually just had a stupid smile on my face the whole time, and it was just a really nice kind of reminder that there was a time that I enjoyed those kinds of games a lot. It was nice to go back to that and feel that again.
Did you play this back when it was new?
No, I'd never heard of it. I spotted it just because it was published by Psygnosis. You know, that was all it took for you know, little monkey brain James to go, hey. Yeah, so it's, man, that Internet Archive is just something special, isn't it? Like, I'd never seen it before now, and I kind of waltzed in there and was just like, what is this? So many wonderful games, and that I happened to pick this one out, which I think was from like the, I think it's from like the early 90s, and the fact that I can play it in my browser 25 years after it came out, and still have a stupid amount of fun with it is just something that really, really warms my heart.
It's also a great opportunity to play the Genesis Aladdin game, which is very good.
That's an amazing game.
Yeah. I must say, I did go and play that when I had enough of Wizardry.
Nice. Just to make it easier. 11.
Yeah, I mean, I never actually owned a Genesis.
Me too. Neither.
I had Nintendo consoles like my entire childhood. So, mm-hmm. you know, this is a good opportunity for me to go back and discover the stuff I kind of missed, that they're not still publishing in those kind of Sega collections and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, this one looks interesting. I'm just kind of looking through the screenshots of it now as we're talking.
It doesn't even look like anything special. You know, it doesn't. It's not the kind of game that you look at and it picks your ears up and goes, oh, I want to try that, you know. Or at least it didn't for me, you know, just the way it looked. But, man, getting once you start running around and getting into it, I was transported to 20 years in the past, and I was sitting in my parents' lounge room with a Genesis controller in my hands. You know, it's crazy.
It's got the developer behind it. It's got some serious pedigree as well.
Really?
The developer. Yeah. So the developer was the one that became originally Raising Hell Software, but in 1994 became a certain developer called Bizarre
Creation. My God, they became Bizarre. That's okay. My mind has just... you just witnessed my brain imploding and exploding at the same time.
Yes. So I think some people know who Bizarre are.
Oh, yes. Well, you were. Should. They should. Because goddamn, they were probably some of my favorite developers, and so it doesn't surprise me anymore that it was published by Psygnosis, because those two had a pretty close relationship throughout their life cycle.
Yeah,
they did. They did. Awesome! What a great morning. Thank you, Matt, for this idea. It was wonderful.
It's fascinating to see, like, the developer that was kind of, you know, behind Geometry Wars and. Yeah. The Club and Blur got its start Project making this like, super cutesy little platformer with little bunnies. Yeah, that's all kinds of weird.
Yeah, like,
and they now have a standing in Playground Games as well. Sorry, who made the Forza Horizon games, which are games that are close to me being a racing game fan.
They did, yes, that's right.
That's awesome. Sorry, Matt.
I was going to say it makes me think of. what's it called? Lost Vikings for Super Nintendo, which was, I can't remember what they were called at the time, or they were under a different name, but the studio that is now Blizzard.
Yeah.
Similarly got its, that's right. Got its start with a sort of silly, cutesy 16-bit platformer.
Yeah, right.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it's hopefully as the kind of the Internet Archive moves on, and more kind of games kind of fall out of copyright and all that kind of stuff, it'd be really cool if we start to see, you know, Super NES games pop up there or Game Boy games, you know, whatever.
That's, you know, finding Nintendo games on the Internet Archive is probably going to be really difficult, especially when they are pushing, well, I mean, not that we've heard any news about Virtual Console on Switch, I don't think, but they have been pretty active in protecting their old licenses and trying to retain them and push them themselves, which I think is a good thing because, you know, that means that they're going to be, well, hopefully, faithfully reproduced in a way that that keeps it sort of close to the original. But on the same token, it's, you know, games that are 20, 30 odd years old at this point, it's kind of, you know, when I think about things like game preservation and, you know, I think those kinds of things are really important. And it would be, I think it would be, you know, it's beneficial for people to be able to go back and play these games in a way that is just as simple as opening up a browser, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is like, the thing that we need to remember is that the Internet Archive is actually legal. It's not a dumping ground for illegal emulation and stuff. So the stuff that's on there, you are actually allowed to play without having to worry about the feds knocking down your door and stuff.
Yeah,
and I think the value that it provides is that archiving side of things. If you look at the film industry lost something like, I saw the statistic once, I can't remember what it is, I think it's something like 80%. 80% of films that were made between 1900 and 1920 or 30 were are lost. Like,
yeah,
they're gone. You'll never be able to, like, the couple of prints that were made of them were destroyed or just aged, and you just can't ever see them again. And we don't want that to happen to the games industry, obviously. We want everything to be archived, and I think that's where the Internet Archive obviously has a serious role to play. And sure. I do hope that eventually, I hope that eventually, when the old Nintendo properties fall out of Nintendo doesn't do something to stop them being archived properly. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, that's what I think. It makes sense, obviously, for Nintendo, particularly for their well-known properties that are still in use. I think it makes sense for them to continue to protect those and get as much out of them as they can. But I do honestly think it would be in their best interest and everyone's best interest if a lot of those lesser-known titles, if they just let them be archived in that way rather than protecting them so heavily to the point that they just get lost.
Just instead of squeezing consumers left, right, and center for, you know, games that they've already played and paid for multiple times over.
Yeah. I must admit, I am one of those consumers who gets squeezed all the time, and just I'll be squeezed again when Switch comes out and you have to pay again for all the virtual consoles, and I'll buy Castlevania again for like the fifth time, and I will play it and enjoy it.
Sound so happy about that.
I do.
And welcome back. That was a track from Sim City, the Super NES version, because I happen to like that one the most. But that's not the one I played for the Internet Archive, because obviously it's not there. But I did go back and I played the original Sim City.
Awesome.
Was awesome. It is awesome. It's still better than the recent one that EA put out.
Of course it is. That was garbage.
I would still rate it higher. But yeah, I mean, obviously, it's a game that almost by itself. And for the time, it was, you know, that kind of ridiculously complex game that people would sit in front of their computer and play for days, weeks at a time. I know I did. I spent a lot of time playing the early SimCity and then SimCity 2000 as well, which I think most people would still consider to be one of the most important games ever made. And yeah, it does hold up surprisingly well. It's a little bit simple compared to some of the more recent city builders, but the basic mechanics are there. The balance is good. And there's still that thrill of kind of slowly seeing that town, which starts with virtually no people in it, slowly grow to be quite a large city, and then have traffic problems, and then you just want to get out there and ban cars because concern for the environment, but just because the idiots just keep driving down the same bloody roads. You know, if you're building these new road networks and they're not using them, you just want to kick them. But yeah, I'm assuming that you guys have both played Sim City in some form or other.
Yes.
Oh yes.
Yes, very much.
Sim City was the game that I played in primary school when it was raining at lunchtime. Stay inside and play a whole bunch of Sim City. Sim City 2000 was the game I played in high school when when it was raining at lunchtime. So. Yeah, a lot of experience with the SimCity games. And just to bring up a point that I was raising before during our Wizardry chat, it's interesting to note how much of the traditional SimCity-style gameplay still exists in city builders today. That, you know, placing of or zoning off sections is still the base building block for basically every city building game. And I think that's really fast. Like, it's been iterated upon like maybe once or twice, but it hasn't really changed all that much from its original form. And I think that's kind of fascinating.
That and the kind of the way the zoning works hasn't really changed in city builders over the years. There is that split between residential and commercial and industrial zoning, and the impacts that those three kind of types of zones have on one another hasn't really changed. And I know that's because, you know, in a very abstract way, that's based on how actual city planning works. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just such a simple mechanic. The idea that obviously people have to be close to work in order to you know, want to live in the city, but if they get too close to their factories, the quality of life drops because of the pollution and all that kind of stuff. It's such a simple idea, but actually balancing it, you know, in the context of a large city that you're building is really difficult, and really the feeling of success when you do it well is really strong. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. The thing about SimCity is, again, a bit like Wizardry, as primitive as you could say the graphics and all of that kind of look, there's still an elegance about it, and it's still quite attractive in that kind of retro.
Definitely.
And this probably applies more to SimCity 2000, which I don't think is on the archive, unfortunately. But yeah, definitely there's that kind of the pixelation, the pixelated graphics, and the actual, you know, design of the buildings in that game is pretty timeless, I think. So, yeah, it was really good to go back.
There's a definite style to how those games, to how all of those games kind of look, I think. And a real elegance to the way that they laid that all out, you know, back in the day, and kind of made it all work And I think that's a real testament to, I mean, that's how you can kind of tell the classics, right? When they hold up in a way that you can play them 20, 30 years later, and there is still, you know, maybe they don't look as great as modern games do, and maybe they don't do, maybe they're a bit more cumbersome, but like you can still feel and recognize the genesis of a genre, you know, coming through in a lot of these in a lot of these games. And SimCity is just one of those. And you know, Will Wright has done it. Who's the, you know, the guy who designed the game, has kind of gone on to do that with quite a few games. I mean, he also helped create The Sims, and he also helped make Spore, which is like a hugely underrated game as far as I'm concerned.
Just to go back to your point about the, I guess, the style of the games, one of the things I've noticed in going back to a lot of old games is the ones that kind of hold up over the years are the ones where you could say that the kind of the game design are quite abstract in, as a result of that, there's a timelessness about them, where they are kind of more, they could be seen as actual art rather than, I guess graphics. So to give you an example, I mean, like Pac-Man or Space Invaders, the kind of the Pac-Man design is kind of iconic. It's not unattractive. It's not old or primitive. It's just, this is, you know, pixel art. Mm-hmm. The same with the Space Invaders, you know, the little Space Invader fillers. And Mario's obviously iconic. So these kind of designs where you get that kind of iconic visual, I think those are going to last a lot longer. And you look at the games that people kind of forget about now, and a lot of them are the games that try and be realistic. A generation or two after the games that we're talking about today. But you look at the PlayStation 1 games, for instance, that have kind of disappeared and nobody kind of talks about them anymore and nobody remembers them that fondly. Mm-hmm. They're generally the ones that try and be realistic, because realism is exciting when it's new.
I feel like realism is exciting when it successfully immerses you in the world that it's trying to put you in, you know?
But it's always temporary.
It's
always temporary. Like,
totally. I completely agree. Yeah. And that's why I find stylized games far more interesting, because they remove you from the things that we already know, which is like a realistic world, you know? Sorry, Matt, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, if you, oh, sorry, other Matt. Huh, you go, Matt.
No, I carry on with this. I'm about to change topic completely.
Okay, I just want to quickly say, I mean, one of the things to remember is that, you know, we talk a lot about something like The Last of Us being, you know, an absolutely stunning looking game now. Two or three generations down the track, it's not going to be. And what, I mean, you look back at the PlayStation 1, for instance, something like Final Fantasy VIII was, you know, as realistic as games kind of got back then. I don't think anybody would look at it now and say it's a particularly attractive game. I think to go back to like SimCity or Pac-Man or Wizardry, those kinds of games are still attractive today because they don't try and be realistic. They didn't try and be realistic. They were more about being about being kind of aesthetically stylized and abstract. And I think that's something that a lot of game developers could kind of take away from going and playing some of the Internet Archive games themselves. You know, they want their game to be remembered in the decades ahead.
Yeah, I think there's a whole other podcast to be had on realism versus stylization, and also kind of where that merge, because I think a lot of games do blend two different styles together with varying degrees of success. But I think the far more important and pressing question I have for you, Matt, is the SimCity that you played on the Internet Archive, how does it compare to the very excellent most recent SimCity that came out a few years ago?
Yeah, it's not. I mean, SimCity kind of got butchered when EA came along. And that's not to say I don't have anything against EA in particular. It's just the property hasn't been managed well under EA. It's not really their competency. So they've done a good job with the Sims. They haven't done such a good job in managing SimCity.
Look at City Skylines next to SimCity, and you will see everywhere that SimCity went wrong.
Yeah, that I was just about to mention. City Skylines is probably the premier example of the genre now.
Yeah, absolutely.
If I was to say there's another one that's probably worth looking into, Tropico is particularly good as well. It's more kind of satirical, which kind of fits with what the original SimCities were anyway. They had that kind of satirical element to them. I think Tropico kind of picked that up and followed well. I must admit that harder to really get into that genre because I find that developers have lost sight of what made the original examples quite good. I generally find myself preferring the classics.
I think one of the things to remember when you're talking about the look of like older games is a lot of that comes from just the sheer... tribal nature, I guess, of the technology that they were dealing with at the time. Small amounts of memory means that you can't have the most detailed graphical assets, which means they have to be super creative with how they use that stuff. And now when you talk about realistic looking games these days, obviously the technology has gotten to a point where graphics can look absolutely phenomenal these days. And I feel like you don't often run into that that same issue that they would have run into back then, where they have to make an early decision based on, okay, how is this game going to look? It's not just immediately, all right, we're going to make this thing look as incredible and realistic as possible straight away, or as detailed as possible straight away. It's a matter of really weighing up the resources that you have available to you. And that's another fascinating part about, going back to the, not to bring it back to this again, but I suppose it is the topic, coming back and looking at stuff from the Internet Archive, is it's fascinating to sort of delve into that side of it, I think. I mean, I find the technical, the crossover of the technical versus the artistic side, I find that super fascinating. And when the two clash and they have to, make decisions that sort of diametrically oppose each other, it's really interesting to kind of try and glean which way the developers went and, sometimes it works out in, if they decided to try something, maybe that's a little bit more graphics heavy. Sometimes it might have worked out back in the day, but often it seems to be that, those that put the effort into, mechanics and making things sort of nicely packaged, those are the ones that seem to last,
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree with you. I guess the other thing that I did discover in going back to the Internet Archive, just to go on a completely different note, is that there was an awful lot of strip poker games released back on the DOS. And
hang on, I'll get my camera.
Those kinds of games are, funnily enough, quite, not that I've played them, is that they probably exist in HTML5 on a browser on websites in some form or other. But yeah, back in the day, there was an awful lot of those kinds of games available at retail, it seems. And talk about games that probably do
Dexy
need
video games.
Realistic graphics. you're probably talking about those ones.
Man, Leisure Suit Larry is all that I can think about when I think about those kinds of like old school, trying to deal with sex, but doing it in a way that is just super juvenile. It's fucking funny. Oh man, did any of you ever play those games? They were completely ridiculous, but hilarious in the same on the same boat.
Well, Leisure Suit Larry is kind of a classic in an odd way these days.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, most games that tried to deal with that topic obviously didn't have the technology to deal with the topic on any kind of level anyway. It was just funny that people tried, I guess. suggest that in terms of that kind of content, you're probably the technology is only kind of just there now. And yeah, that'll probably be a Dead or Alive game down the track. Dead or Alive. I'm surprised I haven't already, actually.
Exactly. That was just exactly what I was about to say.